afternoon. Thank you for coming to this panel on Is Proposition 8 Constitutional? For those who don't know me, I'm Kim Ford Mazrui. I'm on the faculty here. I teach, among other things, constitutional law, employment discrimination, criminal law, and race and law. I also direct the Center for the Study of Race and Law. And we're very pleased to hold this event today. And before I introduce our panelists, I want to enlist your thinking in order to understand a glimpse of what's at stake in this controversy. Have you been to any weddings lately, or even not lately, perhaps your own, perhaps a friend, a relative? Or do you know anyone who's planning to get married, judging by the front page of the Law Weekly? That's usually fairly common. And if so, reflect back as to the feelings at the wedding or the feelings among your friends who are planning to get married. I was just in Long Beach, California last week for a wedding of a former student, Jennifer Shen, class of UVA Law, class of 2006. And the wedding, the festiveness, the excitement, the optimism, the joy, the love, it's just palpable, it's just inspiring. What was also inspiring about the wedding was the bringing together of families from different backgrounds. Jennifer Shen is Chinese-American, and her betrothed, James Barker, is Caucasian-British. It was held in a Japanese garden. And what also struck me was that a generation or two ago, rather than a cause for celebration, their marriage would be a cause for incarceration. That is because they are of different races. California Supreme Court, however, in 1948, guaranteed the right to equal marriage among parties of different races. That was, in fact, ahead of the curve by 19 years of the U.S. Supreme Court in Loving versus Virginia. The California Supreme Court did it again, also being one of the lead progressive courts on equal marriage last May when it recognized the right to marriage for same-sex couples in the California Supreme Court's Equal Protection and Due Process clauses. I happened to be in California with my wife last September at a conference in San Francisco, and I met several people who were elated at the overdue recognition of the rights of gay and lesbian people to marry their life's partners. I met a lawyer who was still blushing from her wedding the week before to her life partner. I met another friend who was still planning the final details of his forthcoming wedding by the end of the month. And what struck me was that same feeling, that same excitement, joy, optimism, and love. Then, of course, a different kind of joy and optimism occurred on November 4th when most Americans celebrated the election of Barack Obama. But in the morning, as we swept the confetti and poured out the remaining dregs in the champagne bottles and took a few aspirin, we heard that there was a dark cloud in an otherwise a sunny November 5th, and that is that the news from California was that Proposition 8 has banned the rights of gay and lesbian people to marry in California, or at least that's its goal. And so we're here today to ask, what happened? What does that mean? What happened to the Supreme Court of California saying this is a fundamental liberty and equality right? Can the people of California do that? What happened to gay and lesbian people who happen to be in love with someone of the same sex and who have been wanting to marry those people? And what happened to the people who already got married? Are their marriages still valid? So those are some of the questions that we will explore today, and I want to give credit to the student organizations and their leaders that organized this. Sarah Frisch, who's the president of Lambda Law Alliance, Gabe Walters, president of the ACLU, and Brett Murfish, president of the Feminist Legal Forum. They and their organizations have put this event together. And our two main speakers are David Cruz, professor of law at the University of Southern California, and Sharon McGowan, a staff attorney with the ACLU LGBT and AIDS Project. I will give a little bit more elaborate introduction before each one speaks, but first I want to welcome Sarah Frisch of Lambda Law Alliance to the podium. She will actually be our first presenter, and as someone that I worked closely with on a paper related to same-sex marriage last year, she is also one of our distinguished speakers. Please welcome Sarah Frisch.
Hi, everyone. Thanks so much for coming. I can say for us, for the Lambda Law Alliance, obviously we watch these events very closely, even on opposite coasts, and we were making phone calls this year to try to get people to vote no on Prop 8, so we've been very involved, but we also just believe that this, what's going on in California also affects us, even though we're not residents of California, and so we believe this is, has consequences for the entire country. I'm just going to go through some events relating to same-sex marriage in California state history, so you have a little bit of context before our distinguished speakers here get started. So I'm going to go back, first start with actually 1971. The California legislature removed all the gender-based pronouns and replaced them with gender-neutral pronouns, and that caused there to be some concern. And then in 1977, Bill 67 was passed, which was explicitly to prohibit persons of the same sex from entering lawful marriage, I guess coming out of this concern that now that it's gender-neutral, there might be some sort of issue there. So that act amended the civil code to define marriage as a personal relation arising out of a civil contract between a man and a woman. Then fast forward to 2000, there was a referendum called Proposition 22, which just made that even more explicit and defined the union of a man and a woman as the only valid or recognizable form of marriage in the state of California. At that point, in 2000, domestic partnerships have been passed in 1999, just to make a note of that, which started with a few privileges, but now in California you have expanded privileges with domestic partnerships. In 2004, as many of you may have seen in the news, Mayor Gavin Newsom directed that same-sex marriages should be performed in San Francisco. 4,000 same-sex couples got married, but then those marriages were invalidated soon afterwards because the mayor did not have authority to bypass state law. Simultaneously with this, the city and county of San Francisco and various individuals sued seeking to overturn Proposition 22. And on March 14th of that year, a judge named Judge Kramer ruled in favor of these couples, saying that there was no rational connection between forbidding same-sex marriage and there was no legitimate state interest to that effect. There was also other legislative action that went on with supporters of same-sex marriage near that time. In the 2005 to 2006 session of the California State Legislature, an assembly member named Mark Leno proposed legalizing same-sex marriage. At first, that didn't get through, but eventually it did get passed by both chambers. California was then the first legislature to approve same-sex marriage without any pressure from the courts. However, at that point, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed what the legislator had done. The same thing happened again in 2007. It went through the California State Legislature, and again, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger vetoed it. He kept saying that it was an issue for the court system or for the democratic process, not for the legislature. So during all of that, there was an appeal to the decision of Judge Kramer, and the appellate court overturned that decision, saying the state interest was sufficient in prohibiting same-sex marriage, and that there was no gender discrimination, and that punted it back to the democratic process as well, saying that the democratic process should be where the change could come from. And on March 4th, 2008, as Professor Ford Missouri mentioned, the Supreme Court of California heard the argument and reversed the appellate court decision, striking down Proposition 22 and the 1977 definition of marriage as unconstitutional. They declined to stay that decision, so that up to this point, over 18,000 same-sex couples have been married. Now we get to Proposition 8. In June of 2008, the initiative qualified to get onto the California ballot with over a million signatures. The campaigns for Proposition 8 on both sides were about 40 million, making it the highest funded campaign on any state ballot that day and surpassing every campaign in the country in spending except the presidential race. Proposition 8 passed with 52.24% of the population, 47.76% voted against it. There are almost 14 million votes cast on that issue. And on March 5th of this year, 2009, the California Supreme Court heard arguments on the constitutionality of Proposition 8. So that's where we are now, and I'm going to turn it back over to Professor Ford Missouri to introduce our speakers. Thank you.
Thank you, Sarah. And before I introduce our panelists, just turn your phones to quiet if you haven't, and also if you do need to go for class, we appreciate the amount of time that you've come for, just do so as quietly as you can. What we will do is each speaker will speak for 15 or 20 minutes, and then Gabe Walters will call on people. I have a sight impairment, so I'm not as good at calling on people as Gabe would be. Let's see. So Professor David Cruz will go first. As I mentioned, he's a professor of law at the University of Southern California. He is also co-president of the International Lesbian and Gay Law Association. He is past chair of the Association of American Law Schools section on sexual orientation and gender identity issues, and he is one of the general counsel of the National American Civil Liberties Union. Professor Cruz's teaching, practice, and numerous publications, I won't list them now, you can go to his website or read his blog. Is it called Cruise Lines, I believe? Primarily focus on issues related to constitutional law and sex, gender, and sexual orientation law. Cruz holds a BS and MS in mathematics from Cal Berkeley and Stanford, respectively. And while doing math at Berkeley, he also obtained a BA in drama. So drama and math. I bet you could play a very convincing Isaac Newton. He subsequently got his law degree from New York University, where he was managing editor of the Law Review and graduated first in his class at graduation. Prior to joining USC, he clerked on the Third Circuit and worked in the Solicitor General's office. Professor Cruz is admitted to the bars of both the state of New York and the Supreme Court. Please welcome Professor Cruz.
I don't know how good an Isaac Newton I'd be. I don't think I'd work in a powdered wig. But one correction of the very gracious introduction. My undergraduate degrees were actually from UC Irvine, the home of the Anteaters. So, zot, everyone. Sarah already told us a lot of the specific background in California. I just wanted to flush a little of that out further and set it perhaps in a national context. In the early 1970s, we saw in the U.S. unsuccessful lawsuits seeking the right to marry for same-sex couples in places like Minnesota, where it got up to their high court, or less hospitably, say, Kentucky. After those early defeats, LGBT activists largely turned their efforts elsewhere to things like anti-discrimination law and the like. And it was in that context, the fight for sort of equality and treatment in other areas like employment and public accommodations, that the statutory clarification of California laws limiting marriage to male-female couples took place. That was adopted just months after Anita Bryant successfully led a campaign to repeal Dade County's law prohibiting sexual orientation discrimination, the Save Our Children campaign. And that is a trope that recurs again and again in struggles for LGBT rights. We saw it in California just a year or so afterwards when the voters considered an initiative that would ban gay and lesbian people from teaching in schools, the Briggs Initiative, which was defeated and which is part of the events that unfold in the movie Milk. If you haven't seen that, you might want to check that out. So activism continued on these other non-marriage fronts until 1993, when a marriage case came before the Hawaii courts under the Hawaii state constitution. Lambda joined that case when it got to the state Supreme Court, and the court ruled that year that the laws limiting marriage to male-female couples classified and discriminated on the basis of sex, and that under the state constitution they therefore had to pass strict scrutiny, and they remanded it for trial. This caused no end of national panic and fear among the traditional marriage forces, leading after some time working on it to the 1996 adoption of the Defense of Marriage Act by Congress, signed by President Clinton, defusing the attempt to get him to take a very unpopular political position in a year when he was up for re-election. 3 years later is when California adopted, as Sarah mentioned, our first initial embryonic version of a state-registered domestic partners law. That was not so much the cause of next year's, the following year's Prop 22, as was the 1999 decision in Baker versus State of Vermont, where their state Supreme Court held unanimously that denying the legal consequences, the rights, benefits, and obligations of marriage to same-sex couples violated their state constitution, but they didn't rule that marriage had to be the solution. They left it up to the legislature in the first instance, which created this new status previously unheard of civil unions, to say, well, we don't want you to be part of the same status as us, and so we're going to create this thing and semiotically segregate you. In 2000, we get the voter initiative, Prop 22, that provided only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California. This was not a change to the California Constitution. It was a statutory enactment, but because it was adopted through the initiative procedure, it could not be directly overruled by a subsequent legislature. It would have to go back to the voters if that law were to be changed. In the wake of that, the legislature continued on the front, as Sarah mentioned, of beefing up the legal consequences of domestic partnership, including eventually making exit dissolution much harder and making you go through the same procedures that you have to do to get a divorce. 2004, we see the San Francisco marriages, which the state Supreme Court, within 6 months, invalidated in the Lockyer decision. And what the court said is, we have very important legal processes that are central to the rule of law and the orderly governance of our society, and those are what you have to follow. You can't just have every city official doing what he or she thinks the state constitution requires. The proper way to do this is to file a lawsuit and to bring it up in the course of ordinary appeals up to us, where we would certainly be disposed to granting review and settling the issue of whether same-sex couples have to be allowed to marry. And that's what the parties did. The very next day, a lawsuit was filed. And Sarah told us about the history of that. When the legislature continued and said, well, our vision of what equality commands includes marriage equality, and passed those marriage bills in 2005 and 2007, it was with reference back to Prop 22 that the governor vetoed them. He said, as I read Prop 22, it isn't limited just to whether we recognize out-of-state marriages, which was how the measure was sold to people. States like Hawaii are going to force California to recognize this. So they said, we'll adopt something. He said, no, it's broader and it's blunt terms than that, so you can't adopt this. Let the courts sort it out. And that is exactly what happened. On May 15th, 2008, the California Supreme Court, in a 4-3 vote, the same vote that we saw in the state of Massachusetts in 2003, held that the California Constitution is violated by excluding same-sex couples from marriage. Chief Justice George, a Republican appointee to the Supreme Court, wrote the opinion for the majority, which relied on basically two grounds. It said that denying same-sex couples the right to marry violates a state constitutional fundamental right, which has bases in our protections of privacy and liberty, and includes a right to be treated, to have our family relationships treated with the same dignity and respect accorded to different sex relationships. And that's why you had to provide marriage. It wasn't just enough to create domestic partnership and give all the rights, which the domestic partnership laws didn't quite do anyway. The other ground for the court's decision was equal protection. They said, under our state constitution, we use basically a two-tier system. We don't have the intermediate scrutiny that we see under the federal constitution. We have rational basis review. We have strict scrutiny. We're not going to consider this to be sex discrimination like the Hawaii courts did, but it is sexual orientation discrimination. In practice, this excludes meaningful access to the right to marry for same-sex couples, for gay and lesbian and many bisexual people. And under our Constitution, we think that needs to be subjected to strict scrutiny. And the court didn't find that the justifications were very convincing, which was especially easy in California because having a domestic partnership law with almost all the same rights meant there's almost no functional argument you can make to keep gay couples out of marriage. Whereas in other previous defeats that we saw, for example, in New York, in New Jersey, New Jersey was a Vermont-like decision, in Washington State, they didn't have civil unions or domestic partnerships. So the question was, do we go from 0 to 60 in one court decision? It was much easier for California. However, there was this lurking shark fin of Prop 8, which had been circulated before the court's argument. It had qualified for the petition process, which only requires 8% of the number of those who voted in the last election for governor to sign a petition to get something onto the ballot and go before the state voters and then get majority approval. It qualified for the ballot. It got the signatures afterwards. As Sarah mentioned, the court rejected a request to stay their judgment. And so starting in mid-June, same-sex couples started getting married, continued doing so up until and through November 4th. Now, all summer long, because the court rejected a pre-election challenge to Prop 8, they said, we're not going to consider it now. It was continuing to be a subject of campaign. The polls showed it down, every single poll, all summer long. And it wasn't until the fall when the TV ads hit and started making concerns, raising concerns, generally specious, about children and what they would be forced to be taught in schools, and about churches and whether they would have their tax exemptions ripped away from them if we didn't pass Prop 8, that we saw a flip in the polls. And on November 4th, the voters turned out and approved it, 52-48. Now, you may have heard a lot about supposed various minority communities, particularly African Americans, but others as well, leading to the passage of this. Those early reports were based basically on one exit poll, and exit polls are already a shaky foundation for creating an assessment of this sort of historical action. Subsequent studies have shown that the single biggest factor, the dominant factor, was age. Old folks don't get it and don't support marriage equality, and young voters do. And you just need more old people to die off and more young people to become voting age and to turn out, which is one of the reasons that this happening in conjunction with the presidential election was very significant. Following age, the other big factor was frequency of church attendance, with those who went to church more than once a week, or at least once a week, voting for Prop 8 in much higher numbers. And that sort of racial and ethnic group demographics really didn't have much of an effect, except for Jews, who voted in tiny numbers for Prop 8. They overwhelmingly opposed it. So what happened? The very next day, people went into court. They filed a challenge to Prop 8, which is called Horton versus Strauss. The basis for the challenge is not that it's substantively wrong, because it's a change to the state constitution, which was the basis for the marriage decision last year. Rather, it's that they followed the wrong procedure. The California Constitution sets out two ways that it can be changed, through an initiative, which can amend the Constitution, or it can start in the legislature if you want to revise the Constitution. Amendments are simpler, revisions are more profound, but the Constitution doesn't define the difference. The state Supreme Court had previously invalidated one proposed amendment that added about 50% to the size of the state constitution, added 12 new articles to a 25-article constitution, added 21,000 words to a 48,000-word constitution. They said that is a revision. You can't just get a petition and send that to the voters. They did that in 1948, incidentally, the same year that they struck down California's ban on interracial marriage. Then in 1990, they struck down one provision of an initiative that did lots of anti-criminal defendant things. One provision, though, said that criminal defendants' rights are not to be interpreted more broadly under the California Constitution than under the U.S. Constitution. The court said, that's a revision. You are changing the independence of our California constitutional guarantees and the court's ability to independently interpret and enforce those rights. And that's been a key feature of our Constitution since the outset, from 1849 forward, and you can't simply do that with just an initiative petition process. That is the basis for the challenge to it. The defenders of Prop 8 say, but look at all the things that the court has said aren't revisions. They upheld Prop 13, which changed how property taxes are done, which ended up very much screwing up the state budget and leading to California falling to the almost very bottom of educational spending in the nation. They upheld term limits for legislatures, which very much change how governance happens. They upheld the reinstatement of the death penalty, various other victims' rights in the criminal context. So they said, look, our precedents say it has to go to the structure of government. On March 5th, the Supreme Court heard argument in the challenge to Prop 8. The challenger said, you should say that this is a revision, not a mere amendment, and therefore they used the wrong procedure and it can't count. Practically speaking, if that were the court's holding, it would be dead in California, because you have to get a two-thirds vote in each house of the California legislature to start something down the revision process. And this is the same legislature that twice voted for marriage equality bills. That would never happen. But they said the reason this is a revision is because it strips away a fundamental right, the right to marry, but it doesn't do it uniformly, like the case where the court upheld the death penalty reinstatement. It doesn't say no one is now free, lacks the right to marry. It said only gay and lesbian and bisexual people. We're stripping the right to marry away selectively from a group defined by a suspect classification, which is the type of discrimination that the courts have stood most ready to remedy, have applied the greatest form of scrutiny, strict scrutiny to. They said this deviates from the core foundation of our Constitution, which is equal citizenship and equal protection. The laws have to be equal for everyone, and if you're going to get away from that, that is such a foundational change, it should be deemed a revision. Now, in the argument before the justices, challengers ran into various snags, right? So part of the questioning said, but look, lots of our cases say it's got to be a change to the structure of government, and this just takes away one right from one group of people. We also, incredibly enough, heard Chief Justice George, who wrote the In Re Marriage Cases decision last year, referring to things like mere nomenclature, when the court had originally written very powerfully about why it is important for equal dignity and respect to have the same institution, and that it's not enough to create a parallel institution to make it constitutional. They received concerns from some of the justices, including the Chief Justice, about, well, does this mean that it's like a ratchet, basically, where the voters could add the right to marry for gay people, but once they do that, it could never be taken away? Can that be true? Can that be a consequence of our definitions of initiative and of revision and of amendment? And basically, the thing that I think is most troubling the justices is their concern that if they were to strike this down, they would appear results-oriented. And there was one tactical error made by one of the challenger's attorneys when asked, when discussing what if it were, say, taking away the right to marry from interracial couples or something, right? And the response was the court would find a way to strike that down. And Justice Carol Corrigan pounced on that. She was one of the reluctant dissenters the first time around in the marriage case. She said, well, that's what I'm worried about, that we would be trying to find a way to do it instead of neutrally interpreting the law. And they're worried that especially after a second vote of the people who, by the way, can vote them out of office because we have retention elections for our judges in California, that they're worried about that. On the other side, defending Prop 8 on behalf of the official proponents, the people who got it qualified for the ballot in the first place, was Kenneth Starr, who you may remember from the Monica Lewinsky investigations, the Whitewater scandals. He was a federal judge before that. He was Solicitor General of the United States. He's a very accomplished oral advocate. He said, look, you've said structure. That's our tradition. That's our longstanding, frequently repeated understanding in the case law. You would be changing things in ways that look results-oriented if you were to strike down Proposition 8. You have to do that. And also, by the way, once you uphold it, you also have to say that the estimated 18,000 same-sex couples who got married can no longer be treated as married by California, because the language is blunt. It simply says, only marriage between a man and a woman is valid or recognized in California. He says, so, here we are. It's March, when they're hearing argument, we have to ask, is this couple that got married last summer married? Well, are they married today? If we say that their marriage is valid or recognized, we run afoul of the blunt language of the amendment. Now, he faced some questions and challenges as well. Part of it, Justice Werdegar, one of the original four, pointed out is, sure, we've often talked about structure of government as being what marks out a revision, but we've never faced a challenge like this before. We've never seen the initiative amendment power used to selectively strip away a fundamental right from a group defined by a suspect classification. So our language has to be taken in the context of the cases that were concretely before us. Similarly, his theory is very sweeping. He conceded. He was very blunt about this. Yes, if I'm right, then any right can be taken away from any group by a mere 50% plus one vote of the people through the amendment process. He suggested that, well, we don't have to worry because we have a federal backstop. The U.S. Constitution will stop the sky from falling. It's not clear how persuasive that's going to be. Chief Justice George pointed out, we are here to interpret our Constitution, which we have long said is to be interpreted independently from federal constitutional guarantees. As for the 18,000 married couples, he ran into a huge amount of resistance because it turns out California has a whole bunch of law about vested rights. They're not just a relic from the early 19th century in cases like Fletcher versus Peck, if you're taking Constitutional Law 1. You have to be very clear when you want to take away a vested right from people, and the language of the proposition and the early, the official ballot measure descriptions, don't make clear, oh, and by the way, all of your friends and neighbors and relatives and coworkers who got married to someone of the same sex are no longer going to be married. Six of the seven justices asked deeply skeptical questions. The seventh one was one of the two dissenters when the court invalidated all of the San Francisco marriages. They said, well, we don't need to do this today, because no one's challenging those, and maybe things will change in the future. So in terms of predictions, everyone I've seen or talked to about this is very confident that the existing marriages will be preserved if the court upholds Prop 8. People are not very confident about whether the court will strike it down. There was a lot that the challengers heard to be discouraged about. It's difficult to make predictions based on oral argument, but there was a lot of sort of basic understanding that we didn't hear coming from the justices. And that is, I think, why we are seeing the campaigns right now gearing up already today to do the political mobilization that's necessary to change minds and votes and get people to turn out if this goes back before the voters in 2010 or perhaps more likely 2012 to re-amend the Constitution to reinstate the right to marry for same-sex couples. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And our second speaker, Sharon McGowan, is a staff attorney with the ACLU LGBT Project, where she's been since 2004. Among her many projects, she has recently focused on cases involving transgender discrimination and also anti-LGBT harassment in schools. She was part of the litigation teams that challenged non-recognition of same-sex marriage in New York and in Nebraska. Prior to joining the ACLU, McGowan was an associate at Jenner and Block in D.C., where she was part of the team that worked on Lawrence versus Texas, the case in which the Supreme Court struck down all sodomy laws back in 2003. McGowan completed her undergraduate studies here at the University of Virginia, as well as took the LSAT, I understand. And then she went on to earn her J.D. from Harvard Law School, or what we call here UVA of the North. Where she was a co-editor-in-chief of the Harvard Civil Rights and Civil Liberties Law Review. McGowan clerked for the Eastern District of Louisiana and on the Third Circuit. She is also co-author of the most recent edition of the ACLU's publication, The Rights of Lesbians, Gay Men, Bisexuals, and Transgendered People. Please welcome Sharon McGowan.
Exciting to be back, and it's also very exciting to have the opportunity to give this talk, which I've done more than a few times since November, that I've colloquially called The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, in terms of where we stand with respect to relationship recognition in this country. And since November, a lot of the emphasis has been on bad and ugly, but as everyone I assume knows, as of Friday, we've had another mark in the column of good. Obviously, many of you, I'm sure, have heard, if you haven't necessarily read, the wonderful decision that came out of the Iowa Supreme Court unanimously. Thank you very much. In Varnum v. Bryan. And it's interesting because one of the things that I learned in the course of doing this work is that the California Constitution actually was based on the Iowa Constitution. And the Iowa Supreme Court has been a historic defender of rights and has a tremendous tradition, as is outlined in the opinion, of standing up for rights far before the U.S. Supreme Court has. It actually upheld the personhood of African Americans 15 years before the Dred Scott decision, renounced the personhoods of African Americans who were held in slavery. It affirmed the right of women to practice law 15 years before the Bradwell decision said that we were too frail. You haven't seen some of my colleagues, I'll tell you. We got some unfrail lesbians doing this work, I'll tell you, right now. And the straight ladies are very unfrail, too, don't get me wrong. But I did want to just sort of pass out this wonderful chart, and as we said, this might be the sort of audience participation portion. This is a great map that's on the website of the National Gay and Lesbian Task Force that gives the update of sort of where we stand in terms of relationship recognition for same-sex couples. And now we get to all take a little blue pen and fill in a nice little Iowa in the middle, very exciting, which I think in many ways is, you know, really a perfect visual representation of, you know, the turning point that we experienced on Monday. This has been a coastal phenomenon, or at least it's certainly been framed as a coastal phenomenon, even though we've actually had some really significant moves and significant parts of the discussion happening in Middle America. But to have the Iowa Supreme Court unanimously affirm the rights of same-sex couples to access the civil institution of marriage, I do think is going to be a game changer in many ways. I think that we've already started to see the legislative dialogue in places like New Jersey and New York be very much influenced by the fact that one of their sister states in the middle of the country has understood that this is a fundamental question of fairness and equality. But just to sort of put all this in perspective, we still are very much a polarized nation when it comes to relationship recognition for same-sex couples. We have now three states, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Iowa. Iowa actually technically, you know, 3 weeks from Friday is when people actually start to get married, but, you know, book your ticket now. I just think that's just like Field of Dreams, like lesbian softball weddings. Can you see it? That's going to be a new cottage industry. I think it's going to be great. And there's this great little clip going on now where there's the little splice from Field of Dreams where, you know, once Ray Liotta comes out, he's like, am I in heaven? He says, no, you're in Iowa. And that's now like the number one gay YouTube clip like around the country. So it's beautiful stuff, really it is. So, so we now have three states where you have full marriage equality as a function of state law, Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Iowa. And interestingly, both Iowa and Connecticut are courts or decisions where the court reached that outcome by recognizing that sexual orientation was a quasi-suspect classification that, while not necessarily triggering strict scrutiny in the way that race or alienage does, did require a more searching level of review in terms of interrogating the state's justifications for keeping same-sex couples out of the institution. And I think those decisions actually really reflect the way in which having that scrutiny ramped up even just a little bit makes it impossible for the state to make some of the arguments that they are able to get away with under rational basis, such as the argument that we only want straight couples to marry because they can accidentally procreate and make babies, and so they need the civilizing institution of marriage. And, you know, in a world in which rational basis is the only thing that you're looking at, well, yeah, okay, yeah, sort of, I get, you know, and but if rational basis is the test, then just even having that means that you win, right? You know, there it is. But once you actually get into a quasi-suspect classification world where you actually have to interrogate whether or not the classification is exceedingly persuasive or, you know, substantially furthers the rationale, all of these arguments fall apart because obviously courts in all of these states recognize that there are same-sex couples who have families, who are raising children. There are many people who enter into the institution of marriage not either being able to or desiring to have children. And in fact, you know, the analysis not only, I think, plays out in terms of, you know, what the level of scrutiny is, but also the dialogue about whether or not same-sex couples are similarly situated for purposes of the threshold equal protection question out of the gate. And there's been a recognition that same-sex couples are looking to enter into the institution of marriage precisely for the same reasons that different-sex couples are, because it is the ordering structure that we have in terms of creating protections, of structuring obligations, and providing benefits for couples. So I think it's a wonderful decision. It's a wrap it up, put it in people's Easter baskets. You know, these little excerpts that I think are you know, warm the cockles of your heart. And so that is really, you know, where, you know, the gold standard that we continue to work toward. But I mean, we don't in any way want to sort of undermine the fact that a lot of the work that's happening right now is sort of below that gold standard, but really getting us to a different place in terms of people's comfort and recognition of the need for structures to protect same-sex couples as well. So we've now have, you know, Vermont, New Jersey, and New Hampshire that all have, you know, civil union systems, and all three of those states right now are in a dialogue legislatively about whether or not they are going to finally ramp up those systems and put them into the marriage tent where they have always really belonged. California is obviously now back in the domestic, well, not yet, actually, but, you know, California is currently in a system where we have domestic partnerships, whether or not, you know, is Prop 8 constitutional? No, of course it's not, but whether or not we're going to win, that's something else, you know, that's different, you know, whether or not we will have a courageous court vindicate the glowing principles of the N. Ray marriage decision. As, you know, I think David did a wonderful job laying out all of the different factors, and I think that we as a movement are geared up and ready for, you know, the worst-case scenario, which is where the court essentially walks away, in part, at least, from some of the really important principles that were outlined in that decision. One question I think that we're also going to need to face is, what does the decision do in terms of outlining sexual orientation as a suspect classification? There was an interesting exchange between Chief Judge George and one of the advocates, sort of, you know, asking, well, what, you feel like you're really giving away a lot here, and there's this question about whether or not, you know, can you really say that Prop 8 overturned the entire marriage decision, and what happens to the suspect classification portion of the decision? And so I think it will be a topic of much scholarship and debate and litigation going forward after the decision is handed down from the California Supreme Court. And for folks who know the process, after a case is heard an argument, the standard process is that within 90 days a decision will be handed down. So we shouldn't be on pins and needles too long in terms of waiting for the California Supreme Court decision to come down. We also have other states like Hawaii that have what's called a reciprocal beneficiaries program that is very similar to the kind of domestic partnership, the comprehensive domestic partnership programs that we've seen. Maine and Washington State similarly have, you know, comprehensive systems that are in place. And so that is, you know, that's the happy part of the map that we are continuing to work on. This map was too painful to circulate, but you can also find it on the task force. This is the ugly part of the discussion. This is a map that reflects the 29 states that have constitutional amendments restricting marriage to a man and a woman under their state constitution, and also picks up the remaining 14 states that I think it's 14 states that have statutory provisions that restrict marriage to one man and one woman as well. 10 of those amendments, fortunately, only are sort of what we call the one-sentence amendments that basically say marriage is one man and one woman, and we've already seen in those states a willingness to keep the rest of the, you know, sort of the rest of the relationship protection pie in play. And, you know, so in terms of domestic partner benefits, other kinds of systems being available, at least in terms of something that legislatures can consider or city governments can consider, you know, that is a place where we continue to do a lot of work in trying to move the ball forward while recognizing that the ability to achieve the gold standard of marriage is something that is going to require a repeal of those constitutional amendments. Unfortunately, though, you know, the remaining 19 have some version of what we call the superdoma. Michigan, Utah, Nebraska are places, you know, where you can sort of use them as representative language, where it basically says, unfortunately, we should put Virginia in that list too. I always try to forget, but Virginia's made like a cottage industry of kicking the gay in some ways. It's kind of really interesting. It's like, how many laws do you need to pass in Virginia, constitutional amendments and statutes, to really get it? No match, no nothing. Get it. So these are states where there's restrictions on the recognition of any status between, in some places it's any married, unmarried couple, in other places it's between same-sex couples. And those are the places that, you know, we don't want to think of any state as being a lost state, but those are the states in which we face the greatest challenges, because there really is very little wiggle room in terms of arguing what, in fact, is left on the table and what can we achieve in the interim, because we know that by creating these vehicles, even if they are just pure, you know, non-benefits oriented, just something that allows someone to be able to register in Eureka Springs, Arkansas, and say, yes, this person is my domestic partner, that we see has the ability to start changing the dialogue around these issues and takes some of the, you know, sort of alien and boogeyman nature out of the arguments of the other side. And so one of the things I did want to talk about, you know, not just listing out, you know, we've got X states in this category and Y states in that category, but sort of, you know, what's the movement's response? You know, what are we doing now? Obviously, we continue to work in places like Iowa, in places like New York, where we're trying to actually get some marriage equality, in New Jersey, where we're trying to ramp up civil unions into a marriage equality state. But I think as a broader national endeavor, we've launched a program that's called TEL3. And one of the things that I think that we learned from the California's experience was that the whole myth that all you need to do is, like, know two gay people or three gay people, and all of a sudden you'll be, like, loving gay people and, you know, out in the streets. And that's not right. That's not right. It's not enough to know gay people. You need to actually have experience understanding why relationship protections, why parenting protections, why safety in schools actually matters to people in their lives, either as an LGBT person or as someone who is a brother, sister, mother, father, daughter of an LGBT person, and engage in that deeper level of dialogue so that people understand why it matters. Because I think David's absolutely right. You know, one of the things that the other side did brilliantly in California and will continue to do is to finally answer that question that, you know, we've always sort of had of, you know, what's the big deal? Why do you care if gay people get married? What's no skin off your nose? What? And they came up with an answer. And the answer was, your daughter's going to go to school and learn that it's okay to be gay. And she, the little sort of, the cartoon that they had, or it was not a cartoon, it was a commercial, which said, Mommy, guess what I learned today? I learned that I can marry a princess. You know, it was devastating. It was absolutely devastating. And I think our movement was like, do we respond to that? Because that's not really right, because that's the education code. So, like, logic brain over here. And other people were like, they're the bigots, I hate them. You know, and they got panicked and worked up and didn't really know sort of, and but yet that was really the thing that they were able to do that we've seen them do throughout, you know, different kinds of campaigns. And there's a way in which that it is the number one line of argument that we're seeing in non-discrimination fights in terms of being able to add sexual orientation and gender identity protections in the state law. It is, your children are going to be taught in school that it's okay to be transgender. That's so horrible, right? So, and so really, I think in some ways the word of mouth campaign that the other side has triggered so effectively has really required us to think about what are we going to do and how are we going to actually dispel those myths. And it's not going to be, you know, one court decision, and it's not even going to be one legislative victory that is going to create the kind of cultural and social environment that allows these victories to not only be sustainable but to actually feel right. Because that's the other lesson that we've learned, is that victories like the California decision that we can't hold on to are devastating. And, you know, ultimately, I think that our community will be stronger for having gone through the California experience. You know, $80 million later, $40 million on each side. I mean, it has really, that has been a game changer in terms of where and how we are able to deploy our resources. But we are winning. We know that. And we know that the other side is terrified, which is why they're spending $40 million to fight us on these things. But it really is a time for all of us to sort of regroup and take that deep breath and fight, you know, sort of the next wave, because we know that this is something that we ultimately will win, but it's not going to come easy, and it's not going to come from sort of sitting back and just, you know, the inevitability argument, while true, I think in many ways, you know, it's whether or not we're talking 20 years or 50 years or 100 years, I mean, that is really going to be a pure function of each one of our, you know, willingness and ability to get out of our comfort zone a little bit and talk about why these issues are so important and why they matter in such a meaningful way. So I'm going to stop there so we can have a chance to have more questions and dialogue. But thank you so much again for having me. It was wonderful to be here.